Leszek on constructing models of interacting topological phases. So a bit of extreme background. We all want to classify different phases of matter and try to realize as many of them as we can. And in terms of classifications, there was a time when we thought that symmetry was essentially all you needed, and later we found out that you actually also need to know about the topology of the system. So you know, this means that if you have two different phases with the same symmetry, they can still be different phases because they have different topology. And so this sort of unlocks a whole bunch of new phases for us to try to classify and realize. And so that's what I'm trying to do, is trying to study some of these new topological phases. So a topological phase can be either short-range entangled or long-range entangled. And so in this introduction, I'm going to talk about the short-range entangled case, where the thing about short-range entanglement is you need, in addition to the entanglement, to get a topological phase, you need a symmetry to get a topological phase. So we call these symmetry-protected topological phases. So here's an example of, here's a table with some very well-known symmetry-protected topological phases. So things like integer quantum Hall effect, quantum spin Hall effect, topological insulators. And the point of the slides is that these are well understood in the sense that we're able to write effective theories for them. You can realize them experimentally. We've done this in different, as you can see, different symmetries in different dimensions. But the point of this slide is that one thing these very well understood phases all have in common is that they're phases of free fermions. So the question is, can you get any interesting topological effects if you have interacting phases? So can you get any new topological phases, and what kind of properties will they have? So in terms of classification, there's been a lot of work done on classifying the different topological phases. So in particular, for a given symmetry and dimension, we know how many short-range entangled topological phases to expect. But this doesn't tell you everything about these phases, and you can ask questions like, how could we make such phases? What kind of properties would they have? And so to answer questions like this, it can be helpful to have models which actually realize these phases. And that's why we're going to try to construct such models. And as sort of foreshadowing, it can also be useful if you can study these models numerically. So I've been trying to construct a variety of different models of topological phases. The one I'm going to talk about in this talk is where we've had the most success, which is a system with a U1 symmetry in 2 plus 1 dimensions. So you might remember from the table a couple slides ago, this is the same symmetry and dimensions as the integer quantum Hall effect. And so you might expect some similarities between interacting phases with this symmetry and dimension and the topological phase of free fermions. And so you'd be right. From just the classification of these interacting phases, we know that for this symmetry and this dimensions, there's an integer number of symmetry-protected topological phases, just as there's an integer number of integer quantum Hall effects. And people were also able to show, so there's a way to write your effective theory of an integer quantum Hall effect is in terms of a Chern-Simons theory, which you can write in this K-matrix form. And these authors, Lu and Vishwanath, were able to write a K-matrix theory of these interacting topological phases and reproduce this integer classification. And so basically the K-matrix theory can describe both the integer quantum Hall effect for free fermions and the similar phases where you have interactions, which they've called the integer quantum Hall effect for bosons. So now, in the case of free fermions, you don't have interactions between the fermions, except for you have a statistical interaction. So if you interchange two fermions, you get a phase in the wave function, as you all know. And so since this is the only interaction between the fermions, we know that some of the topological behavior in the integer quantum Hall effect comes from this interaction. So if we're going to get a topological phase of interacting particles, we want the interactions between the particles to take the place of the statistics. And so we're actually going to study phases of interacting bosons. So we know that this topological behavior is coming from the interactions themselves and not the statistics. And we want an interaction between these bosons, which can sort of realize a similar effect in that if you interchange two of them, you get a phase in the wave function. And we think this will give us similar physics to the integer quantum Hall effect. And so the way to do this is to use something called flux attachment. So you imagine that your bosons, in addition to carrying charge, also carry flux. And because they carry both charge and flux, if you interchange them, you get an Aronov-Bohm phase. And so this is just you get a phase upon interchanging particles, except that now it's not a statistical phase. But you expect that you can get similar physics because in both cases, when you interchange particles, you get a phase. And so these authors were able to show, Senthil and Levin, were able to show that if you do flux attachment on bosons, you are able to realize this topological phase of interacting particles, this integer quantum Hall effect for bosons. So now I'm going to talk about my own work. Now, unlike the previous slide, we study a system which actually has U1 cross U1 symmetry. So a U1 symmetry means that you have a conserved species of particles. So U1 cross U1 means we have two different conserved species of particles. And the reason we need two, I'll show you in a couple slides. And we want to do something like flux attachment. But the thing about flux attachment is that you can't sort of go out and pick up an object which is a boson that has both charge and flux. They aren't sort of elementary particles. And in part because of this, you can't write down a microscopic model which has this flux attachment. And we want to be able to do that because that'll allow us to, for example, do numerics and also potentially answer different questions about these models.
Yeah? So can you go back one time? So when they do this flux attachment on bosons, between 2 plus 1, this boson plus flux, is this just, formally, is this just another type of particle no longer a boson? If you tell me that you put some flux to boson, it becomes a fermion. Isn't that the same as starting with fermions? What's the fundamental difference?
So I don't...
this thing, right? This
is
some flux to this boson.
Yeah, I guess I don't know much about how the flux attachment works. I'm going to show you in our actions, we start with sort of bosons which aren't flux attached, just ordinary bosons. They're able to show that they sort of pick up some flux. So there's emergent particles which carry both charge and flux. So in our work, we definitely start with bosons. I guess, I don't know if you could argue that this object, if you're starting with it, maybe you're starting with a system of fermions.
I
don't know about this. Difference. Yeah.
Same thing as putting some transonic field and couple this to transonic field that affects plus. So the Hilbert space would be bosonic Hilbert space and the transonic field and not the fermion. There is some difference.
Okay. Yeah. What we're going to do is sort of get us around this by starting with a system of just ordinary charged bosons and showing that you have emergent objects which carry both charge and flux. And that when we expect that when these objects condense, that will realize this topological phase. So that's what we're going to try to do. An outline for the rest of the talk. So first, I'll just provide an example of an action which causes, in terms of ordinary bosons, which causes objects with charge and flux to emerge. I'll then show that we have a sort of a more general method for getting different phases which have different numbers of charge and different numbers of charges and fluxes. And then I'll show that these phases are in fact topological phases. And then I'll make some connections with some other models. So before I do any of that, I need to tell you more about how we think about bosons in these models. So a system of bosons in two dimensions, you can think of it as an O2 quantum rotor model, where the rotors are just the phases of the bosons. And you can write such a rotor model in terms of currents instead of in terms of the phases. And then you can make sort of a Trotter decomposition to one higher classical dimension, and you end up with a three-dimensional classical action in terms of integer-valued currents. And the currents actually work out to be constrained to form closed loops. So let me give some examples of how different phases look in this loop language. So for example, in a superfluid, it's a condensate of bosons. And in the loop pitcher, these currents are going to have very low energy costs. And so you have a lot of current loops. That's how a superfluid looks in this loop description. And conversely, a Mott insulator, the currents have a very high energy cost. And so only small loops are allowed to form. So this is when the bosons are gapped, currents have a high energy cost. So that's one convenient way to describe a system of bosons. I'm now going to talk about another way to describe a system of bosons, and I'll explain why in a minute. And that's in terms of vortices. So again, in two dimensions, the bosons have phases. And you can describe these phases just in terms of their vortices in two dimensions. And these vortices are point particles. And so because they're point particles, you can repeat this procedure to map them to a three-dimensional classical action in terms of closed current loops.
So the winding of these loops map directly to the superfluid density?
Yeah.
The
yeah. We don't ever allow things to wind.
Okay.
But it would. So
is your bosons half-point bosons or one-point bosons?
you allow two bosons to fall on top of
them? Yes.
They're
ordinary bosons. So the loops can have integer strength, they could have strength 2, which is just like saying you have two bosons.
So these vortices, you distinguish them from particles with the flux, and is that vortices to be attached to something that keeps that thing of flux?
I'll get to that in a second. Hopefully you'll see in a minute. So a vortex will have flux.
Yeah.
It's not attached, now it doesn't have charge, it just has flux.
Yeah.
So the vortices have sort of the opposite behavior. In a superfluid, you know that vortices are gapped, and so the currents see a large energy cost. Only small loops are allowed. In a Mott insulator, the vortices are condensed, so you see only a small energy cost for the currents, and you can have large loops of vortices. And you can see the vortices and the bosons have sort of opposite behavior, and this is due to a duality between the bosons and the vortices. So there's actually if you have an action in terms of bosons, there's a well-known way to rewrite it as an action in terms of vortices. And when you do this, you see that if the bosons, for example, are gapped, then the vortices must be condensed, and vice versa. So the reason I introduced vortices, which you've anticipated, is that if the bosons carry charge, the vortices carry flux. And so you might think if you can bind a boson to a vortex, this will be the object which you want, which carries both charge and flux. Now, so one problem with this is that both the boson description and the vortex description are complete descriptions of a phase. And so you can't describe the same physical system as both bosons and vortices. You have to pick one. And that's why we have two species of bosons. That's why we have the U1 cross U1 symmetry. So we can describe one species in terms of bosons, one species in terms of vortices, and then we can bind bosons to vortices. And this will give us an object carrying both charge and flux. And we expect when these objects condense, this will be the topological phase. So now I'm going to try to write down a microscopic model which realizes this physics, which binds bosons and vortices.
Are you assuming the charge of the bosons is the same?
Yeah, you don't have to, but in this model we have. And I think you would get similar results if you didn't. It's quite easy to see what would change if you don't assume that. So we're going to work on a three-dimensional lattice, and this is just a classical problem on a three-dimensional lattice. These current loops live on the links of the lattice. So on every link, we have current loop variables. So the first species of bosons I'll describe in terms of vortices. And in this talk, Q is just going to be a letter, which means that this is a vortex variable. So these are, vortex variables of species 1. And they're just currents which live on the links of the lattice. So in this picture, on most links, Q1 is equal to 0. But on this link, Q1 is equal to 1. On this link, Q1 is equal to minus 1, and so on. And these currents are constrained to form closed loops. And for the other species, we describe it in terms of bosons. So in this talk, J means bosons. And so again, we just have a bunch of currents on the links of this lattice, and they're constrained to form closed loops. And so we could try to write an action in terms of these variables. So this is sort of a general action that we could write. This first term is essentially the energy cost for having loops of the Q1 variables. So if you have Q1 not equal to 0, you pick up some energy cost. And the energy cost is related to this. V is just some potential. So for example, if V is very large, the Q variables would be gapped. If V is very small, the Q variables will be condensed. We have a similar term for the J variables. So again, just an energy cost for having loops of the J variables. So like this configuration has some energy cost. And then there's some interaction between the two variables.
Q1, J are similar variables.
Yeah, so they follow sort of the same rules. They're both integer value conserved currents.
Yeah, okay.
So if we want to bind bosons to vortices, what we do is we just pick particular values for VQ, VJ, and VQJ, which allow us to write the action like this. So here, lambda1 and lambda2 are just some small real numbers. And so we have a term like this in the action. So here, you see that when lambda1 is small, for example, you have Q1 equal to 1 and J2 equal to 0, this will have a large energy cost. And same thing if you have like a loop of J2 by itself, which would mean that J2 is equal to 1 and Q1 is equal to 0. So the case where what doesn't have a large energy cost is if you have Q1 and J2 equal on a given link of the lattice. So you see how this action can bind a boson to a vortex. And it'll actually have these objects will be condensed. So there's a one nice thing about this action is that you can simulate it in Monte Carlo. So this is just a three-dimensional classical action. There's no sine problem, so you can just put it on a computer and simulate it. Though I should mention that the simulations are hard because it's helpful to have a interaction between the vortices, and this is some long-range interaction, and so it slows down the Monte Carlo. Another thing about this action is that I promised a couple slides ago to write down an action in terms of just physical bosons, whereas I've sort of done something in a way similar to the flux attachment in that I have an action in terms of sort of some quasi-particles of the bosons, where here the quasi-particles are these vortices. So I still haven't written down an action sort of only in terms of just bosons and nothing else. And so to fix that, what I can do is perform this duality transformation on the vortices. So I say there's this procedure from going from description in terms of vortices to a description in terms of bosons and vice versa. So I can just apply this procedure to these vortices, Q1. And when I do that, I'll get an action in terms of some variables which I'll call J1, which are just the boson variables for species 1. So I can just, it's just a procedure. I put this action in, I sort of turn a crank, and I end up with an action in terms of J1 and J2. So I'm going to do that now. I'm not going to show the details. I'm just going to show the result. So if I do that, this is the action that I get. So now I have interactions between, you know, just interactions between different loops of the same type for J1, for J2, and I have this complicated interaction between J1 and J2. Q1, yes, and it's a boson variable, whereas J1, Q1 was a vortex. And so if these VJ1, VJ2, W, they're potentials which have this fairly complicated form. That's actually so complicated that I wrote it in K space and not real space, and so K is just the wave vector. F of K is it's a lattice derivative, so in continuum it would just be K here. So one thing about this action is that I've now had to introduce another lattice. So initially I had Q1 and J2 variables on the yellow lattice. And basically if I have an object on the yellow lattice, the links of the yellow lattice, and I take its curl, I get an object on a different lattice whose sites are the centers of the cubes of the first lattice. So you can kind of see this here, you know, if you take a curl of this loop, you get an object which is coming out of the slide, and it sits right here on the white lattice. And so the reason I've talked about this is because during the duality procedure, I took the curl of something. And so to get these J1 variables, they actually end up living on this white lattice, which is sort of the dual to the yellow lattice. And that sort of explains the form of this term here. So I want two objects on the same links. And so by the curl of J1 is going to be on the yellow lattice, and I can compare it to the J2 currents. So this is an action. It's a microscopic action in terms of a physical boson variables, which realizes this physics of binding bosons to vortices and getting objects with charges and flux. So before I start talking about the topological properties of this action, I want to show how to make this action a bit more general. So you might be wondering if this action works for other potentials apart from these very specific ones I've shown that it works for. And another thing that would be nice to do is so we had one boson bound to one vortex. We can get some different physics if we bind multiple bosons to multiple vortices. So that's another thing I would like to do. I should also mention that this action can be written as the path integral of some local quantum Hamiltonian, which is might be convenient. So to get a more general action, I'm going to use a change of variables procedure, which we developed in an earlier work. So this change of variables procedure will just allow us to write this action. This is the same action as we had on the previous slide. I've just shortened the notation. I've gotten rid of all the lattice indices. And these VJs now, they could just be, they don't have to be the specific ones I showed on the last slide. They could just be sort of any potential. And so I'm going to make this change of variables now. The first step in the change of variables is to just undo the duality we did before. So I'm going to apply the duality transformation to the J1 variables. And this will get me an action back in terms of Q1 and J2 variables. The next step in the duality procedure is to define some new current loop variables. So these are going to be integer valued current loops. So they're just the same in sort of their constraints as the J and Q variables, but they have different names. They're called G2 and F1, and they're linear combinations of the old variables. Here, A, B, C, and D are some integers which to make this work, they have to satisfy this constraint. And so I have some new variables here, which sort of So if you write A, B, C, and D as like a 2x2 matrix, then it has to be part of the the modular group. And so basically you want, so this wouldn't work, for example, if like, imagine if like C were 0 and D was 2, like G2 is just like 2J2, then G2 could only be even integers, whereas I need G2 to be an integer valued variable. So that wouldn't work. So you can show that as long as this A, B, C, D are elements of the modular group, then this will work. And so that's why I have to make them satisfy this constraint.
So would you then have a plus sign in front of C and
A? No.
No? Okay.
I don't think so. No. I'll say no. Actually, so it's a modular group, but you can also do like a charge conjugation operation.
If you're selling a transformation,
yeah.
With those charges, you've chosen the signs in a way that it's modular.
Yeah. So actually, I think the inverse is the modular. Is that right? No, that's not right either. Okay, so there could be plus signs. It doesn't matter, I guess. You can also add a charge conjugation operation to the operations of the modular group, and then this will work. And so, but I probably should have put plus signs there, but and then I wouldn't have to talk about that. But it does work with the minus signs. So these f and g variables have the same properties as the j and q variables in terms of them being integer-valued conserved current loops. And because of that, I can do the same duality procedures on these new variables as I was doing on the old variables. And in particular, I can dualize the F1 variables. So I can, and I'm going to call the variables conjugate to them. I'm going to call them G1. And so what I've done here is I've gone from this action in terms of Q1 and J2. I've made the change of variables to F1 and G2. And then I get this action in terms of G1 and G2. So this is it's just an action in terms of new variables. It has the same form as this action. It's just going to be like G1 squared plus G2 squared plus this G1, G2 term, except it's going to have different potentials. And the potentials are functions of the old potentials as well as these integer coefficients. And so one nice thing about this is that when the g variables are gapped, we're going to realize this binding physics. So gapped means that only small loops are allowed. So for a given link on the lattice, G2 is most likely 0. And so this, when I say G2 is gapped, I basically mean that G2 wants to be 0. And to make G2 0, we have to have sort of CJ2s bound to DQ1s on each link to get this to be 0. And so what we can do here is we can find out, if we're given some action in terms of the J variables, and we want to know, can you realize such a binding phase with this action? How we can do this is we try to find the A, B, C, and D integers where if we make this change of variables, we get some gapped G variables. And if the G variables are gapped, then we've realized the binding phase. So this sort of tells us how to make this more general, that if, so for a given potential, can you realize the binding phase? It also tells us how to get different numbers of bosons and vortices bound together by choosing different C and D.
This probably goes back to my question on the charge of the bosons. I wonder if you allow different charges. You probably get relations about the ratios of C and D and D, right?
Yes.
I wonder whether those ratios would be changed if you allow bosons with different charges. Because I assume that coefficients will appear because of J2 and J1 reflect the fact that.
Yeah. So actually, I mean, what would happen is, and I'll show in a couple slides, I'll be coupling the J variables to electromagnetic gauge field, and so there'd be some coefficient there. And basically, I carry this coupling term through the change of variables to get things like conductivity. And so one could imagine just putting a coefficient in front of the original coupling term and carrying it all the way through. And I'll talk about this again when I get there. But it's probably pretty straightforward to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So again, we want to bind bosons to vortices. And so in our loop language, gapped means basically it vanishes. Or I guess to be very precise, in the gapped phase, you can sort of, there is a point where there's just no G variables. So if in a trivial insulator, you can sort of imagine you have some cost for having the bosons. And that cost caused you only to have small loops in this loop language.
So the G variables are already coupling the vortex and the boson, right?
Yeah, so that's how the G variables are defined.
Gap, what does that mean?
So
that's
So it means that in this loop language, G is equal to zero if they're gapped. Or it's in the same phase as the point in the phase diagram where G is equal, where the G on every link, G is equal to zero. So that's how I think about the phase, is that in this phase, G is equal to zero, at least, or it's, it guess it flows to zero in some way. So G, actually, physically, if you imagine having so some condensed object of like two bosons in a vortex, say, G is actually an excitation out of this loop. And so such excitations are gapped. And so that's why I say that the loops are bound. So now what I'm going to do to continue to analyze these models is I'm going to choose specific potentials for these J's so that I can get a very easy to analyze action. But the results I'm going to say should be true for sort of general potentials, assuming I can find an A, B, C, and D that work. So if I choose convenient potentials for the J's, I can get a G action that I write like this. So here, lambda 1 and lambda 2 are some just real numbers again. And this is a convenient action because these are now short-range interactions. And you can see that when lambda is very small, the G variables will be gapped because they'll see a very large energy cost. We also have this fairly complicated coupling term between the G variable, between the different species of G variables. So to understand this coupling term, you have to realize that this AG2, it's an internal gauge field. So it's an integer valued current, though it's not necessarily constrained to form closed loops. And it's defined so that G2 is the curl of AG2. What this term does is that it gives you, when you have a loop of G1 and a loop of G2 interlocked, it adds a phase to the partition sum, which is given by just the coefficient e to the 2 pi I b over d. What this corresponds to in the quantum case is interlocking loops in this three-dimensional classical action corresponds to interchanging particles in the two-dimensional action. So this is like a mutual statistical interaction. If you have an object of G1 and an object of G2, and you interchange them, you get a phase in the wave function, which you should expect because I've already said they carry charge and flux. A couple interesting things about this action. One is that when d equals 1, this term is actually the phase you're adding to the wave function is just an integer multiple of 2 pi. So basically, such a loop doesn't actually contribute to the partition sum. So the g's behave as uncoupled loops. And this allows us sort of to get the phase diagram, for example, very easily. Though I should mention that even though they behave as uncoupled loops, because they carry both charge and flux, you can still get topological phases out of them. Another thing that's nice about this action is that with this choices, these potentials are short-ranged. And because they're short-ranged, we can do numerics easily. And so the numerical results I'm going to show are going to be related to this action. So let me first try to show the phase diagram of this action. So the phase diagram is different depending on the value of d. So when d is equal to 1, as I've said, it's just two uncoupled loops. So each uncoupled loop has already been studied in the literature. And we know there's a phase where the g variables are gapped and a phase where they're not. And there's some phase transition at some well-known point. So I'm just going to put this phase diagram on this axis and this axis to get this phase diagram. And you see that when lambda 1 and lambda 2 are both small, you have this phase where the G variables are gapped. This is the binding phase I wanted to realize. If D is greater than 1, you can get more complicated phase diagrams. In particular, for this example with D equals 3, we have this trivial phase where the original J variables are gapped. But again, we have a phase where the G1 and G2 variables are gapped. So again, we can get this binding phase. And it turns out you can get this binding phase for all D with the action I showed before. And this phase diagram we had to get numerically. You can't get it analytically.
So that number there, 1, 2, 3, 2, 5, mm-hmm.
No, because this is just a system of uncoupled loops. So you can basically ignore this term and just look at this term. And forget about the flux carried by the loops. Just pretend these are ordinary loop variables. And this is just a classical Monte Carlo problem, which people have studied numerically before. And they've been able to extract these phase transition points.
Okay, so D is equal to 1, and that sets what lambda 1, and lambda 2 as well.
No. So d is equal to 1 tells you basically how the b and d tell you what kind of phase you get when you interchange the particles. And so d equals to 1 tells you the phase is trivial. And so you're just studying essentially this action with some. So this is just some potential with some parameter here telling you the cost of the loops.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering where the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 comes from, where
it's coming. I mean, it comes from a paper where they just studied this action. And yeah, I don't think it's universal. I think it's for this thing on a square lattice. It's not that important in terms of understanding the system. I've just put it in to show that like people have determined that there is a phase transition here and they've studied it in some detail.
No, but the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 defines your coupled phase, right? Between the vortex and the boson.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there must be some significance for the cost, like the alpha.
Yeah.
Beyond that it's an uncoupled phase, right? All the other 3 phases are.
Mm-hmm.
The
physics of just an uncoupled system of loops. You can, I don't know. The G behave, well, okay, I'm just gonna keep going. It's adding a flux to a G variable adding like one flux to a bunch of bosons you could think about like instead of changing the boson, you change the vacuum in some weird way, and so the boson will still behave the same way, but you'll have like different conductivities. But it's, I don't want to go into it because I don't fully understand it, so I shouldn't even said anything. So we can realize a phase where we bind different numbers of bosons to different numbers of vortices, and so now we want to know, is this phase topological? And so there's different ways to answer this question, and one that we're going to try to do is we're going to measure a topological invariant. So if we can find some quantized topological invariant, that will suggest it's a topological phase. And since we have this analogy with the quantum Hall effect and that we have the same symmetry and dimension, we're going to try to measure just the Hall conductivity and see if it's quantized.
So my understanding is that you've got this phase diagram like choosing some special form of.
So the phase diagram could change with different potentials, but the phase should still exist. And I haven't shown these arguments, but you can make arguments that the phase will still exist.
I wonder if you could have some simple picture about the original boson. What is the potential? What kind of potential is being directed in the original? Do you have that? Can you trace it back?
No, not really. So we want to measure the Hall conductivity. And to do that, we're going to give the original J boson some charge. So here I've given them the same charge, but you could put some coefficient here if you wanted to have them a different charge. So I give them some charge, and I just want to calculate the conductivity. So I could do this just by applying the Kubo formula. The problem with this is that you get the conductivity in terms of a bunch of sort of correlators between the currents, and these can be pretty non-trivial. And so we can measure them numerically, and we're going to get results that are the same as the results I'm about to show. But there's an easy way to get to measure this conductivity analytically, so that's what I'm going to show in the talk. And the easy way to do it is to carry these external gauge fields through this change of variables to the G variables. And the reason why this is good is because the G variables are gapped. And so because they're gapped, the current-current correlators will all vanish in the thermodynamic limit. And so we can easily extract the conductivity from what's left. So in particular, we add these terms. We do the change of variables, and we get the following extra terms in the action in terms of the G variables. So, and in particular, we get this term, which doesn't even contain any G variables. So this is just taking this, going through the change of variables, and seeing what happens to these terms. You get a term like this, and this is just a Chern-Simons term. And so based from its coefficient, we can figure out the Hall conductivity. And so we see we get a quantized Hall conductivity. Which is related to C and D, which are the integers we used in the change of variables. In particular, we bound C charges to D vortices and got such a conductivity. And so, yeah, I mean, if you added a coefficient here, you would, I guess it might end up here, but I haven't done this. It is. Because of the constraint, AD minus BC is equal to 1, there's a relation between B and C. And actually, what it corresponds to is that C is equal to B plus like N times D, where N is basically, so this could, you could change the conductivity by 2 or 4 or some, you could like C over D plus N. And that corresponds actually, well, I'll answer that question better in a second. So we have a quantized Hall conductivity. So this is our evidence that we do have a topological phase. And in particular, we are binding D vortices to C particles. So actually, the properties of this phase depend on D. So for D equals 1, this gives you an even integer Hall conductivity, and which agrees with what's expected for the integer quantum Hall effect for bosons. So this is the integer quantum Hall effect for bosons predicted by Santhal-Nevin and Lewin-Bishmanoff. We have an integer number of different phases. We have basically one different phase for every C, which agrees with the classification that there should be an integer number of phases for this symmetry and dimension. In addition, if D is greater than 1, so if we bind multiple vortices to a particle, we get a rational Hall conductivity. So this, we're going to call this the fractional quantum Hall effect for bosons. Unlike the previous phase, this phase has topological order, which you can see both from this and you can see it from we have a fractionalized charge. So when we carried these fields through, we got these extra terms in the action. And these terms tell you how much charge the gapped excitations have. And we see that they have a fractionalized charge when D is greater than 1. So we see that either for D equals 1 or D is greater than 1, we can have different either fractional integer quantum Hall effects for bosons. And in regards to your question about C and D, so changing for a given B, there are multiple different C, and they're all different by just adding a layer of integer quantum Hall effect to the system. So you have a fractional phase, and you can add integer phases. That's how they differ. So with that knowledge, we can go back and talk about the phase diagrams of the model. So we can label this bottom phase as the integer quantum Hall insulator. We can label this phase as the fractional quantum Hall insulator. And you notice we get some interesting phase transitions between, for example, the fractional quantum Hall insulator and the trivial insulator. For a larger D, we can get even more intermediate phases. So we can have like multiple intermediate phases here. And the highest, the one up here, will be a trivial insulator, but the rest will all be different fractional quantum Hall insulators. So that's one way to see if the system is topological. Another thing that we could look at is the edge state. So if we had this analogy with the quantum Hall effect, we expect to see some gapless edge states in the system. So one argument that we will have these edge states is if we go back to this language where we're binding one boson to one vortex, and we describe one species in terms of bosons and one in terms of vortices, then this is the action I showed you earlier. I've made a change to it. I've added this eta function, where when eta is 1, it gives you the topological phase. And when eta is 0, this is an action which just gaps out the J variables. So this is a mod insulator. So for example, I have this system here is divided into two parts. This part is a mod insulator, where the bosons are gapped and the vortices are condensed, so small loops of bosons, large loops of vortices. In the topological phase, both the bosons and the vortices are gapped, but these condensed objects, the combined objects are condensed. So you have large loops of vortices bound to bosons. And a question you can ask is, what happens if you combine a boson with a vortex? Or what happens if you have a vortex which is trying to cross the boundary? And on one side, you're going to combine this boson with a vortex. On the other side, the vortex is just by itself. But these things are constrained to form closed loops. So the way that the bosons form closed loops is they run into themselves along the edge. And this is sort of our qualitative argument as to why we have edge states. I can also make a more quantitative argument, because in the numerics, we have access to the phase variables of the bosons. And so I can measure correlators like this. And this kind of correlator will decay exponentially if you're in the bulk of the system. It'll decay algebraically if the system is gapped, and algebraically if the system is gapless. So we can measure this in the bulk, and we find that it's gapped. We can measure it on the edge, and this is the data I'm going to show you. So here's the correlator on the y-axis, the distance on the x-axis. It's a log-log plot, and we get straight lines. So this tells you you have algebraic decay. So this is sort of our confirmation that we have gapless modes on the edge. These different plots are, so this is for bosons of species 1, this is for bosons of species 2. And the different colored lines correspond to different locations in the phase diagram. So as lambda gets smaller, we're going deeper and deeper into the topological phase. You can see that the exponent of the power law, which is given by the slope of these lines, changes as you go deeper into the topological phase in a way which I'll try to explain in a couple soon. So one last thing I'll do before I'm done is try to connect our model to sort of K-matrix Chern-Simons theories. the way to do this, you first have to talk a bit more about how we actually do this duality transformation between bosons and vortices. And what the duality actually means is you go from an integer valued variable to you have these J boson variables and they're integer valued. And you want to make them real valued. That's what the duality is. It's making them real valued. And so you replace them with these real valued objects alpha, and you say that J is the curl of alpha to make J divergenceless, because it's the curl of something. And the way to make an action in terms of alpha equivalent to an action in terms of J is to add additional variables which couple to the alphas like this. And the reason you do this is because now if you were to sum out the Qs, which are these new variables, it forces the alphas to be integer valued. And so now earlier in the text when I was going from the J to Q formulations, what I would do then would be to integrate out the alphas and then just have an action in terms of the Qs, which are the dual variables. I don't actually have to do that, though. I can leave the alphas in. It's still the duality. And so with this method of doing the duality, I'm going to go through the change of variables again. So I'm going to dualize the J1 variables to get Q1 and J2, make the change of variables to F1 and G2, and then dualize the F1 variables to get G1 and G2. When I was doing this, I introduced two real-valued fields alpha, one when I did this duality and one when I did this duality. And these two real-valued fields have a Chern-Simons form. In particular, they have the following K-matrix and charge vector. And so from these K-matrix and charge vector, you can determine the conductivity. It's the same as we got from earlier methods. You can also, if I gave you more information, you could have determined things like the fractional charge and the mutual statistics of the model as well. And a nice thing about this K-matrix interpretation is you can do something called the bulk edge correspondence, where if you try to write an action on the edge of the system in terms of the boson phase variables, which are going to be called phi1 and phi2, then the bulk edge correspondence tells you that if you have this K-matrix, you will get a term like this in that action. You'll get some other non-universal terms as well, but you'll definitely get a term like this. And so what we did was we assumed that the other non-universal terms are all quadratic. We integrated out one species of the phase bro. So we integrate out phi2, and we get an action in terms of just phi1 alone. And then we could try to compute this correlator with respect to that action. So we do that, and we can actually, from this, determine the exponent of the power law decay. And we find it's some non-universal number, which isn't that interesting. But then we can repeat the process, and this time find the exponent of the decay of phi2. And it turns out the product of these exponents is equal to d squared. So this just comes from this term. And so here's the numerical data where I've plotted the exponent of species 1, the exponent of species 2, and you see that the product stays constant at 1. This is a system where d is equal to 1. The deviations are likely due to some other. We assume there are only quadratic terms here. There may be some other terms, which are why it's not exactly 1. So this is just a nice check because we have. So giving the K-matrix theory from our theory is kind of a non-trivial thing, and the numerics are also kind of complicated, but you see that they agree really well. So I'll talk for 1 second about how we do the numerics. So we have an action like this. We need it to be sign-free. So we have this complex number, which is giving us a sign problem. And we can get rid of it by applying this duality procedure to one of the species of bosons. Now, there's a number of different ways you could do this. The way I'm going to do it to get the most convenient way to do it is to, so this is the duality I used for the K-matrix theory. I'm going to replace alpha with a real-valued variable J, and I'm going to enforce the divergenceless of J by adding yet another auxiliary variable phi. And integrating out phi forces J to be divergenceless. And then if I integrate out the J's, I get an action which I can study in Monte Carlo. So basically, do this to the J1 species, leave the J2 variables the same, and you'll get something sign-free, which you can study quickly if you have the right J potentials. So that's all I wanted to say. To sum up, I've been able to find a physical action which binds bosons to vortices. And this gives us composite objects carrying both charge and flux. And then I was able to show, by measuring both the quantum Hall conductivity and the edge state, that the resulting system was a topological phase. And I was able to study this system numerically. So some extensions which we're thinking about doing with this model, we have some interesting phase transitions between different fractional quantum Hall plateaus, or you could possibly engineer some between other different to all the different topological phases I've talked about, and so we'd like to study these phase transitions. We can also, in the numerics, potentially look at things like disorder or lattice defects and see what kind of effects they'll have. Another sort of moral about this is that we have a vortex, which is a topological defect in two dimensions, and we bound a charged particle to it, and we condense this object. And this gave us a topological phase. And we can think of applying the same philosophy to other systems. So we could take, for example, in 1D, your topological defect is a domain wall. So you could think about binding a charge to a domain wall and condensing these objects. And we've actually been able to show that this gives us topological phases. And we could also try to extend it to three dimensions where you have a hedgehog as your topological defect. And you could try to bind some charged particles to those and condense them and try to get some topological phases that way. So that's all I have to say. Thanks for your time.
Questions?
So I will ask the dynamic question. So for bosons, I mean, if you attach flux to them, right? So if both are ordinary bosons, then when you move them close enough, they can actually sit on top of each other, right? But if the flux attachment is such that they become fermions, this should not allow to be happen. So what am I, what's the contradiction here? Because you, because normally I understand that this kind of flux attachment works for hardcore bosons, right? So,
so the reason it works in this system is because it's actual mutual statistics. So you have, they're not like fermions. You have, if you have a G1 and a G2 and you interchange them, that's when you get the phase.
Yes.
And so they're not like fermions because it's, if you have a G1 and a G1, there's no phase upon interchange them. So they're mutual bosons. And so I think then you can put them on, then you can put as many G1s as you want together because they aren't, they don't have statistics with respect to each other. I don't know.
I thought one of them says, you know, things which have, which are topological defects, and which also might have flux in them. Right? Does any of the stuff that you talked about apply to monopoles? Or monopoles be an example of this monopole?
So that's another thing that we could try to get a topological phase. And that's what we are trying in three dimensions. They're harder, so these dualities no longer work because to get monopoles, you need like an SO3 object. We had two U1 objects, so we had all these nice dualities. And so in two dimensions, U1 cross U1 was sort of the way to go. Now that we've gone to three dimensions, now we're sort of, basically, if we wanted to do two dimensions, U1, U1 is maybe the best way to do it. When we go to three dimensions, we need to have monopoles, and so that's why we're going to try to do the same thing with monopoles.
See, again, it's continuing the naive question. I mean, when I first saw the title of your talk, interactions in topological phases, interacting in topological phases, I was just sort of thinking, okay, let's have a cylinder with, let's have a current, a surface current. And then I always thought that as stable, the topological phase. So that it wouldn't be disturbed by different things. So, surface interactions or anything really, stable phase. So now when you bring in this interaction or this possibility of interaction, does it have any implications for considering a topological phase for quantum computation? And is there any, I don't know, it's a very, very long stretch, but do you have any comment on that?
I don't think so. No, I don't know.
Okay, I mean, basically, I thought of a topological phase as something that's stable to, things like charges interacting with it.
Yeah, okay,
almost anything, really. So, does this call into question anything you've done so far, all this, the idea of the stability of a topological phase?
No. So these phases should all be stable if you do things like, So things like, you know, breaking, like doing something locally, as long as the loops are still, you have this condensate of loops of bound objects. And even if you sort of do something which like breaks up the loops locally, you still need to close them somehow. And so this sort of protects you from, yeah, I think there's nothing here that would say that you're going
to. But what you just said adds to my understanding.
So in principle, maybe you need some fancy mutual statistics or something, but do you reintroduce a sign problem? Like, I didn't quite understand how you got rid of the sign problem there. So if you have more fancy mutual statistics in general, can you always get rid of that sign problem?
I don't know. The reason we were able to do it is because we had like a, I don't know how it generalizes. The idea is you dualize one species and you get rid of the sign problem. And this seems to always work. We don't have any reason why. And so now if you have, for example, more than one species, I don't know if it works, because like you only have one duality you can make. And so like the other two. So different things like this, I don't know about any extensions, but yeah. So.
Yeah, it seems like that if you put the system on torus, you have d squared ground state, right? Because the k matrix was like dd. So this gives d squared a billion anions. Have you tried to make modifications on models so that you get like another billion anions?
We've thought about making such modifications. Yeah, it's so a lot of, like, for example, getting rid of the sign problem relies on you having these dualities. And so a lot of the things you could try to do to give yourself non-abelian anions would break these dualities. And so you have to sort of, well, the idea is to try a bunch of different things and maybe one of them won't break up. Like, it will be still consistent with the dualities. So that's something we're thinking about.
What's everyone looking at me? One more question.
Excellent. Very intelligent question. So when you say we can apply, or you asked, can we apply these two other systems when we talk about one plus one d? You're replacing U1 with Zn.
Yeah.
And what is this?
So the reason we do that, I probably should explain this. So you need to have a domain wall. And so you need a symmetry group which basically whose top wall, who can get you domain walls. And U1 can't because it's a continuous symmetry. So you need to have Zn symmetry so you can get domain walls between the different. Does that make sense? So, you know.
So I can't imagine that those. I mean, if you had U1, I thought you would still get domain walls, but you could change that
foundation. I guess we could, but there's, it's easy to study.
Okay, so it's easy. But then, you have done this already. You have looked into this.
Yeah, we have. I just didn't talk about it.
Did you get the same conclusion? Did you review the same classification?
Yeah, so we're able to read. There's recent papers about the different symmetric topological phases you can get in like Zn cross Zn chains, and we can reproduce all of those phases. That's what you're asking. You can't get topological order phases. You can just get the symmetric topological phases, which I guess people already knew were there.
So you reproduce all possible phases with that symmetry?
Yes.
Okay. Awesome talk. Thanks, Scott.